Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. A special thank you also to Ashraf Garda for letting the cat out of the bag. Yes, indeed, we have been nominated as a show for the South African Radio Awards, and we couldn't have done this without you, the listeners out there, supporting us and allowing us to keep doing the very best that we can do for you. That being said, let's get straight into the show. Let's not waste any further time. In 1909 on this day, a gentleman by the name of Moses Josiah Mabhida was born on this day. That would be obviously the gentleman who the stadium in Durban is aptly named after. 1965 on this day, Kellogg's Pop-Tart pastries were created. 1979, Chuck Berry would be released from prison on this day after having been arrested for income tax evasion. In 1998 on this day, a portrait of an artist without a beard would be auctioned off for $71.5 million. That portrait itself would have been painted in 1889, and the artist in question is none other than Vincent van Gogh. In 2006, on this day, the Nintendo Wii would be released for the first time in the US. In 2018, on this day, sticking with the theme of releases, we would see leaked emails or released emails, hundreds of them, belonging to one Ivanka Trump, around deals that would have been structured with government and benefiting some of the private investors in her network. I wonder if we'll see that come back next year. It's going to be a new year. It's going to be a Trump 2.0. I wonder if we'll get an Ivanka 2.0 and some more email releases. 2023, though, on this day, Novak Djokovic would win his 7th ATP World Tour Championship, beating one Jannik Sinner for that particular title. I'm sure Michael Abramson will touch on this in his sports update a little later on, and I'm sure Jannik Sinner is happy that Novak Djokovic is retiring. But you're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha, and on the show today, we are taking a look at the construction mafia. Hot topic. It's been a hot topic for years now, not just months. And we're going to take a look at this with the new Minister of Public Works and Infrastructure, Dean McPherson, around what it is that they're doing. There was a summit that was held today. There was a declaration that was signed. And we're going to unpack that and see if we can make sense of what's happening there to try and tackle that. Then we've got a conversation with Tsepo Khadima, independent analyst, around the Eskom update. We're going to do a couple of updates there. We're going to look at the suspensions that were put in place by the Minister of Electricity and Energy on some nurses officials, as well as some tariff hikes, as well as the recoding of meters. We're just going to get a general update on what's happening in the world of Eskom and what it means for you and I as consumers. Then we've got a conversation around Airbnb. It seems as though there are new restrictions that are being put forward for Airbnbs in South Africa. How are they going to affect Airbnb owners? How they're going to affect you and I as consumers renting out Airbnbs this festive season? And if these restrictions are going to take effect before the end of the year? Then we're going to wrap things up with a look at a very interesting discovery by a PhD student in research at the University of Pretoria, who has uncovered two new dung beetle species. We've already got more than 500 of them in South Africa. We're adding two more to the list.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
And we kick things off as usual with how the markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Head of Research at FNB Wealth and Investments, Chantel Marks, to take a look at some of the market movements and see if we can make sense of them. Good evening, Chantel. Lovely to speak to you. Let's start with local markets. We'll go to international markets in a second. Let's start with local markets. It seems as though markets are finding their footing. Some sense seems to be returning to the markets, because following the Trump trade, I didn't know whether we were going left or right or up or down.
Yes, and I mean, if you look at intraday trading, it still seems a little bit topsy-turvy, but generally we seem to be moving slightly higher. I mean, a day like today, usually we would have ended, well, a year back, we would have definitely ended in the red, and we wouldn't have seen support from the mid-cap space and the small-cap space and financials. So I think that at least from that perspective, there seems to be some support for the SA Inc. trade still, even though we don't know what a Trump 2.0 actually holds in.
Chantal, when we look at some of the commodities counters, I mean, resources were the leading index, or the leading sector rather, for the day. Commodities pricing last week was torrid to look at. This week, not better, but significantly better than it was last week.
Yes, it does. It does look a little bit better. I think to a certain extent, the dollar strength that we've seen has faded somewhat, so that impact isn't as pronounced. And we have seen gold do particularly well. So if we look at golds today, Harmony, for example, up 4.4%, Goldfields up 3.9%, Pan African up 4.8%. I think a lot of that, that gold price strength being reflected in the resources sector performance on aggregate today. And that's a function of a little bit of fear returning to markets. There's some renewed rumblings around Russia and Ukraine. And I think that that has resulted in the gold price pushing higher. And then, of course, that fading effect from a stronger dollar last week.
That Russia-Ukraine war hitting 1,000 days since it was officially begun, and that's obviously still weighing in on sentiment 1,000 days later. Chantal, let's look at some of the international markets. Asian markets all having a green day, whereas European markets all had a red day. Now, we do have some data points that are coming out. We do have CPI coming out of the Eurozone at some point. We've got South African CPI as well, set to come out as well. And, of course, our own interest rate decision that's still to come this week. Take me through just what you've seen in the international space in today's movements.
Yes, so I think from a European market perspective, we do have inflation numbers on the cards, and markets do tend to be quite nervy around those readings. And I think for Europe, it's even more pronounced because they do have a growth problem, and the expectation is that if inflation can remain in check, they could see interest rate cuts, and that could be in aid of growth. That tends to filter through or jump over the pond to the UK as well. And then the UK has the added pressure, I think, of also being a commodity-heavy bourse. So they tend to be quite impacted by commodity pricing as well. I think that is basically why you are seeing a little bit of a discrepancy in trading between European and Asian markets. And then, of course, Japan kind of does its own thing because the Japanese economic makeup currently is so unique relative to the rest of the world. And monetary policy has diverged completely from the rest of the world. So they tend to kind of run in their own direction. And in China, it's all about stimulus. I think that investors have been underwhelmed by what we've seen so far, but I think that the hope is still there that something really meaningful will come through to help the consumer that side.
Chantal, when we look at US markets as well, they have their own sets of challenges to deal with in the form of Donald J. Trump, who will be returning to the White House, whether we like it or not. We saw inflation print come through last week. No surprises there. We kind of know that the cabinet changes that are going to be implemented are going to be quite significant from a US perspective. How are the markets kind of trying to anticipate that and price that in? I mean, I'm looking at things like bond yields. They're still ticking higher as though we might be in for a recession. But at the same time, we are expecting interest rate cuts, in fact, 2 for the rest of the year.
Yes, so I think that bond yields are basically expressing the expectation that inflation could pick up again, because some of the policy measures that were put forward by Trump on the campaign trail will theoretically be inflationary, like the introduction of some very, very stringent tariffs. So whether or not that gets implemented and when that gets implemented, I think will have an impact on inflation. But what the Fed can do right now, and the only thing they can do right now, is look at the data that is in front of them. And the data is still saying that inflation is continuing to tick down. Inflation seems to be contained for the moment. The jobs market is pretty strong. The housing market looks okay, even though we do have some lumpy data here and there telling us that things aren't looking that great. So they'll maintain their near-term trajectory. The question mark is around how deep and long this cutting cycle is going to be now that we've got a change at the helm. And that they don't know. They can't really make decisions based off of an if, maybe, or when.
Chantal, one final question. I'm hoping you know the answer to this. Where's the Rand going to be at the end of the year?
So, technically speaking, the rand should strengthen from current levels. It does seem a little bit oversold at the moment. In the same breath, the US dollar seems a little bit on the strong side at the moment, particularly if we look at near-term rate cuts. So technically and theoretically, it should be stronger at the end of the year. But a lot of that will depend on market sentiment, and that's impossible to predict. We don't know if there's going to be further escalation on the war front. We don't know what the market perception is going to be around Trump 2.0 at the end of the year. There's still a lot to digest there. So sentiment driven, I have no idea. But if we were just looking at fair valuations, the rand should be stronger at the end of the year.
When you say stronger, Chantal, give me a number. 1750, 1750?
Yeah, I mean, probably between 1715 and 7050.
Okay, that's not so bad. I think we can sort of live with that for the year. I mean, we would want to obviously see below 17 Rand. There were analyst calls for 1680, but I suppose that might be subject to a lot of those factors that you mentioned still being outstanding, and of course how things will shape up. We'll leave it at that, Chantal. Thank you as always for the time and for the insights. That's Chantal Marks, Head of Research at FNB Wealth and Investments, taking us through the market movements throughout the day, some Rand expectations, as well as what could potentially be driving market sentiment around the world.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
63 billion rand is the number we are looking at. It is the value of project disruptions since 2019, according to the Deputy Minister of Public Works and Infrastructure, that has been lost as a result of the construction mafia. We're going to dig into this in a little bit more detail with the minister who is tackling this problem head on. That is the Minister of Public Works and Infrastructure, Dean McPherson. He joins me on the line now to take a look at this and see if we can make sense of it. Good evening, Minister. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with the 63 billion rand. That's obviously not a small figure, and with your experience in the KZN province, and the KZN province being named as one of the key provinces where the construction mafia operates, your thoughts?
So just to say, Jimmy, that this is around, you know, obviously projects that have failed to complete. That's the total value of them. It's not money that is essentially been lost, but it's the value of the projects. Obviously some money has been spent on them, and you know, it's obviously a crisis, and that's why we convened the National Construction Summit on stoppages today to hammer out an agreement between the Department of Public Works, Infrastructure, the National Treasury and SAPS on how we can develop a common themes to tackle the matter and deal with it once and for all. So we build investment confidence, we're able to build our projects out, and we are able to make a dent in the infrastructure backlog.
Minister, take us through that summit that took place today, some of the outcomes that came out of that, some of the key deliverables that have been noted for tackling this serious problem.
So we signed at the end of the conference what we have termed as the Durban Declaration on the construction stoppages, which looks at five key areas, specifically around law and order, facilitation, emerging enterprise support, and others, so that we are able to now systematically work through these issues and deliver then work streams that will actually expand on them, whether it revolves around legislation, whether it revolves around procurement. Social facilitation was a big issue today that we think is not being done correctly. We need a uniformed approach to that so that we don't have sort of different provinces or different municipalities doing their own thing. And it was really, I think, quite historic that you could get three departments like that to agree now on a common approach to this issue, which is, you know, sort of been a shotgun approach up to this point. We've drawn a solid line in the sand politically and legislatively, and said, you know, the full might of the state is now going to come down on this issue and decisively deal with it. And that hasn't happened up to this point. So I'm really grateful to the MECs from across the country that came, the Minister of Police, the Premier of KwaZulu-Natal, deputy ministers and officials for the hard work that took place. And we had some difficult but frank and necessary discussions that have brought us to this point. So I think that we are now headed in a new direction, which I'm really excited about.
Minister, we'll get into the legislative side of it in a second. I want to look at the political will or the collective effort to deal with this problem. What kinds of measures are you discussing and looking to put in place? I mean, this is clearly something that requires some very serious consequences to be put in place if we are to see anything meaningful take place. And it's not just a case of saying we spoke about it, but to actually have real consequence in place.
So we're looking at important things like making sure that construction businesses are registered with the Construction Industry Development Board, so that when tenders are evaluated and awarded by the state, that we know that they are competent companies that can deliver on the tender requirements. We're also looking at law enforcement technology advances, particularly around data analytics, so that we can seek to predict and get an advanced notice on where disruptions may be. And we're also looking at this common model of facilitation. We heard from some really good examples in KwaZulu-Natal and the Eastern Cape around how they were able to quickly get projects back on track after they stalled, and starting facilitation a lot earlier than just sort of after the tender has been awarded. So I think that there's a mistake that we've been making, is that we wait too late and then the projects immediately become delayed because the facilitation process has begun too late. And we've also said very clearly that we need to reimagine and revise how the 30% local procurement rule is applied, because that is the gateway to what is going on. And it actually shuts out black emerging businesses. They were, the biggest losers in this whole issue. So, those are the kind of tough discussions that we had. We were all on the same page on how we need to move forward. That's why we signed the declaration. And now it's time to put that into action.
Minister, I appreciate all these efforts and the roadmap that's been paved, but let's be quite frank, between you and I, and everybody knows this, the construction mafia doesn't play by the rules. They don't play fairly. So when you are coming into the situation from a standpoint of a rational approach towards a problem that has long since lost its rationality, are you not putting yourself at a bit of a disadvantage here?
No, I mean, look, we were also honest with ourselves, Jimmy, to say, I appreciate that there are officials in my department that collude with these people. So the mafia has almost attempted to legitimize themselves by actually bidding for contracts. It's an extraordinary situation. So, we've got to root out those people internally and externally that are a threat to the state's procurement and infrastructure plans. But the reality is that it is not a fight that we can lose.
Mm.
It's something we must win. We must win whatever the cost, because if we cede any more ground and any more space, it is South Africans that will suffer the most. Ultimately, we've said that, let's look at what came out in the quarterly labor force survey last week, where we saw great numbers out of the construction industry, 175,000 jobs. Clearly, there is confidence being built back into the sector. We now need to build on that. And if we can add more jobs in the third and fourth quarter, that's the kind of growth that we're looking for. So I actually see construction as a growth opportunity in the country. I want to see those shares prices of our listed companies getting back. I mean, they're sort of 50-60% undervalued at the moment. And when we start to see those kind of things, I know that we will have succeeded. But we're going to be unrelenting. And we have the support of the entire government on this issue now. And by working with communities, by working with legitimate businesses, by using legislation, by working closely with Minister Mgcunu, who is a breath of fresh air in the police ministry, I'm absolutely confident that it is a battle that we will win.
Minister, before I let you go, you touched on the fact that we are obviously in a very critical phase, and the president has said this himself, saying that South Africa is pretty much in the infrastructure phase, and he wants South Africa to look like a construction site, which without a doubt puts a lot of pressure on your department being responsible for all the infrastructure development that we are anticipating. There are investors out there that have put in money into projects, and you're dealing with this in the form of the 3 billion rand in backlog that you're trying to work through as a department. How do you then go back to international investors, local investors, the investment community and say, put your faith in us. Not only that, put your capital in us. We can assure you that we've got the situation under control and we can assure you that projects will be delivered.
Well, I mean, these are the discussions that I had with investors when I travel, both domestically and internationally. And I must say that they have that faith in us. You know, the government is putting its money where its mouth is now. It's allocated 950 billion rand over the medium term for infrastructure. The National Treasury has radically overhauled the regulations around the BFI, around triple P's. Those will be finalized by the end of November. So, I mean, all the signals are there. We have a solid pipeline. It's now time to match that pipeline with funding and financing. We're working hard at that. We have a solid construction book that we want to complete partnerships with funding institutions. For the first time ever, we have a multilateral bank that is coming out here in early December from Asia. They've never funded a project in South Africa, but they're now coming to do their due diligence in their country due diligence. I mean, that's a sign of faith in what we're doing and how we're packaging our projects. You would have seen the announcement we made on project preparation and the fund that we have put together, the bid window. That is another sign of confidence that we have and that we want to work with the various arms of the state and entities so that we work closer to ensure that our projects are bankable, are feasible, and can get off the ground a lot quicker. So these are all the mechanisms that we've put in place. The unfortunate thing with infrastructure is that, you know, people only see it when it's complete. I do think that in the years to come, the decisions that we have taken now will pay off handsomely for us.
Pay off handsomely they must, because the country can ill afford to not get this done and not get this right. The minister who has the unenviable task of dealing with the construction mafia, Minister Dean McPherson, joining me to reflect on that construction mafia and the summit that they've put in place, amongst other measures, to try and tackle this so that we can get things back on track. Thank you very much, Minister McPherson. We'll leave the conversation there. We look forward to seeing the fruits of the hard work that you and the team are putting in, and we look forward to catching up as the progress is being made.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best forex rates around. As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise, and you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
There have been a couple of developments related to Eskom and some of the decisions that they've been looking to take, tariff hikes chief among them, obviously. But there have also been some interesting suspensions at NERSA that have taken place. I'm joined on the line by independent analyst Tsepo Radima to take a look at these developments and see if we can make sense of what's going on. Radima, thank you so much for the time. Lovely to speak to you as always. Let's start with NERSA. Suspensions within the NERSA leadership team by the Minister of Energy and Electricity. Are you surprised?
Well, I am surprised, more so because of the timing of the suspension and more so because of the apparent secrecy, which in fact is an anathema in state institutions, that there could be, you know, such a suspension could be shrouded with secrecy. I mean, the minister, Dr. Hosien Soramokgoba, is duty-bound in terms of the Constitution of the Republic to have been a little bit more transparent and provide information as to the circumstances that led to having taken such a drastic decision of suspension at the time of the hearings, and more so taking into account that the particular individual who is subject of this suspension not long ago admitted publicly that NERSA had been applying an incorrect methodology to determine tariffs of electricity, which of course means that we are now, we have experienced an 850% tariff increase which is totally unwarranted, and therefore there are supposed to be steps to actually correct that that error, because we will give it to them that it maybe it was an error in terms of interpretation of the relevant statute. But I think we would have been interested to hear from the minister in terms of what action measures he's taking to ensure that that error is corrected by revising the tariff downward or to drop the tariff, instead of actually now, effectively punishing the messenger, because the message itself still remains.
Dr. Khadima, you touched on the tariffs, 850% increase. Obviously, as you said, we would hope that the tariffs would come down, but instead, Eskom is still pushing for a tariff increase. In fact, the Eskom CFO saying that those tariff increases are essential. You and I have spoken about this before at length, to say that recovering the losses from municipalities or from the mispricing or from whatever it is that Eskom's looking to recover losses for, the solution is not to make the consumer pay more.
Well, I mean, that is a zero-sum game to try to make the consumer to pay more, but it's actually more devastating to the economy of the country. South Africa is no longer a competitive country globally, and hence we are going to see an accelerated rate of deindustrialization of this economy purely based on energy. I mean, we've just seen with the US elections, Donald Trump making a promise that within a year he will cut energy costs by 50%. And that includes, of course, liquid fuels as well as electricity. But that is the tonic that this economy needs in order to be able to grow sustainably and to create the necessary jobs to reduce the unemployment, and therefore have electricity consumers domestically who are able to afford to pay. It is not surprising, at least now, that I think the municipal debt, so-called, is said to have ballooned well over 90 billion rand and will soon be 105 billion rand. So who comes in to bail out these municipalities? It is National Treasury, and National Treasury doesn't have money of its own. Of course, it's the taxpayers who have to continue to with those bailouts. So a 36% tariff increase when people cannot afford electricity today, I cannot understand how, in good faith, both the government in terms of the Minister of Electricity, NERSA, and Eskom itself can hold course to sustain the argument for higher tariff increases, more so when we know, as a matter of fact, I mean, I'm on record as having stated that Eskom has got over 80 billion rand a year of fruitless and wasteful expenditure. And if anything, these hearings, we should have been for tariff increases, Eskom should have been telling us what exactly they are doing to reduce that 80 billion rand a year in fruitless and wasteful expenditure, not tell us that actually their primary energy costs are increasing, whereby in terms of coal to a whopping 93 billion. And then in there, you have another 36, 37 billion rand of totally redundant electricity that they continue to purchase. And they are not taking any measures to actually reduce, because the actual cost per kilowatt hour to produce electricity should be 32 cents and not 44 cents. And those are the measures that I think we are interested to hear, that does Eskom have the gumption to drop the primary energy cost factor to 32 cents instead of 44 cents and totally sequestrate from their income statement the 2.48 rand or so of intermittent energy, which in any case is 100% useless on the grid.
Tabo, there was a time in our lives, I'm sure you remember the time, but it seems like it was a very long time ago now, where Eskom was bragging to the world about having the cheapest electricity in the world, or being able to produce electricity at the cheapest rate in the world. I imagine those days are behind us, and the numbers that you're giving me suggest that we are quite a way away from that. How do we reconcile this now, understanding that there was also a time where Eskom said to us, we need to improve the energy availability factor. That seemingly has improved now that we don't have load shedding. But how do we now go from having the cheapest electricity in the world to now continually having north of, as you said, 850% worth of increases?
Yeah, we have everything to have electricity or to maintain that coveted position of being the lowest cost of electricity producer globally, because that is what is key for us to be competitive as an economy. And indeed, it is possible. As I say, Eskom today can drop its primary energy cost from coal to 32 cents a kilowatt hour. And Eskom is supposed to cancel or terminate all the take or pay or the so-called evergreen coal contracts, whereby, I mean, their financials are yet to be released. But if you look at the previous year's financials, they had more than 89 days of coal stockpiles, meaning that is coal that would never be used in a very long time. But that was over 11 billion rand of capital that was trapped there and at a higher cost in terms of maintenance. The electricity tariffs today where we stand should be in 2025 at 1.22 rand a kilowatt hour before you add VAT. So 1.22 rand plus VAT, that should be, and this must be the argument that should be made in this NERSA tariff hearings to ensure that as an economy, and we also, the rate of default. Remember, as we sit here, Eskom, yes, they now are claiming to have reached 70% energy availability factor, and we congratulate them on that. I am on record as having said that load shedding is gone once and for good. It will not return. But the factors that led to load shedding being gone for good is not only the improvement in terms of the energy availability factor, because their energy efficiency factor is still low, but it has been the exodus of customers who have been migrating off-grid. Today, that figure stands at over 10,000 megawatts of electricity demand, which historically would have been supplied by Eskom. It is now gone completely off-grid, and some of it has just completely been shut off with energy-intensive industries that are also labor-intensive having shut down. So effectively, you are looking at an organization here that wants to attempt to maintain the status of being the largest company by revenue from 850 million rand a day turnover to now being a 1.24 billion rand a day company in terms of turnover. But I can't see how they will be able to achieve that. And if indeed they do get their way, get awarded this 36% tariff increase, with municipalities then coming in at 44% tariff increases, you are going to see an accelerated rate of default, and you will have a Eskom that in within the next 12 months will have to come back to Treasury for yet another bailout, because certainly the consumer is no longer able to sustain the really colossal tariffs that we are enduring. But this economy itself, it is just simply not going to afford that. We should take a leaf out of Trump's campaign promises, that we too in this country drop the tariffs to 1.22 rand, standardize. I mean, I was curious to see what the CFO of Eskom yesterday stated during the hearings, that they have got the negotiated price agreements, and those negotiated price agreements, or the NPAs, I think they call them, you find they are discriminating their own customers in violation of even the constitution, because they are a state-owned company, that we are not paying a standardized uniform tariff. And that's what some of us are calling for, a standardized uniform tariff. And that standardized uniform tariff must be 1.22 rand. Then we are competitive. Then the rate of default is completely reduced, and the customer migration, the exodus, is itself arrested.
The maths needs to maths. It needs to all make sense, and we need to figure out how to best handle this tariff situation because it's unsustainable, and we'll leave the conversation there. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. Thank you so much, as always, for the insights. Ntate Khadima, Tshepo Khadima, independent analyst, are joining me to take a look at the latest updates from Eskom around the tariff hikes, around the suspensions that have taken place, and what it all means for you and I as consumers.
Hi, my name is David Getonga from BitKE in Kenya. I'm on the MoneyWeb podcast with Karen Ryan. At BitKE, we educate East Africans on crypto, and we'll be discussing stablecoins adoption and what's happening in East Africa.
Don't forget, join me, Karen Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
And we're taking a look at some interesting developments in the world of Airbnb. We would ordinarily look at this probably as part of our property feature, but it is Tuesday, so it technically does still kind of count, even though we are doing Agri Tuesday. We're going to take a look at the latest round of proposed regulations that are being put forward for Airbnb owners and how that'll affect the owners, but also how it'll affect you and I as those booking those Airbnbs. Joined on the line by Direct at Only Realty, Grant Smear, to take a look at this, see if we can make sense of it. Good evening, Grant. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with the regulations. What are the new regulations being proposed?
Evening. So some of the regulations are firstly to regulate the Airbnb platforms and other short-term rental platforms, and that's just to manage mainly the use of the properties that Airbnb owners are putting on the market or onto the platforms, and limiting the number of nights potentially that they can use those for Airbnb.
Grant, why would the government want to put these kinds of regulations forward? What's going on here? Are there regulations like this around the world?
Yeah, there's definitely a global movement towards regulation and restrictions of Airbnb properties, particularly in sort of high-density cities. Barcelona, San Francisco are good examples, London as well. And I think the government are taking a look at those cities and the regulations they're implementing and considering those, particularly for Cape Town, because Cape Town does carry more Airbnbs than a lot of other cities around the world.
Cape Town has more Airbnbs than some European cities. You're very right about that, Grant. How will this then affect the Airbnb landscape? I mean, obviously with some of the regulations not being finalized yet, we don't really know who's going to be affected for sure. But what does this then mean for Jimmy, who owns an Airbnb in Cape Town and wants to then put that on the market? Am I now going to be restricted in how long I can put it on the market, or how does it all work for the owners?
So there's a few facets that I think. Firstly, there's licensing regulations, the licensing, making sure that Airbnb owners that are putting their property in the market are properly regulated or licensed, are making sure that their properties are good for use and meet the regulatory requirements. But secondly, is limitation on the use of their property and how many nights, for example, they could put that on Airbnb. The impact on that is that a lot of property in Cape Town CBD and the Atlantic Seaboard have been bought on the speculation of Airbnb, so the increased rental that they can achieve. And if the regulations do come into effect and restrict the use, then we could see an issue around pricing of properties, so decline in prices of properties, more properties coming to the market, and more properties coming to long-term market, which would or be a benefit to tenants because rentals would potentially come down.
Grant, how much of that market is a long-term market in terms of long-term rentals, perhaps? I want to get a gauge of how much of the longer-term rentals are going to be affected.
Look, I think, it's just over 23,000 Airbnbs on the market. We'd see a significant amount return to the long-term market if there are restrictions. There has been an increased movement of long-term rentals across into the short-term space, so that's why there's been a real limitation on stock in the CBD and the Seaboard. So I can't tell you how many would come, because there'd be two different results. One would be the sale of properties, and secondly, entering the long-term market, maybe waiting for prices to stabilize. But it would be significant because, you know, like any hospitality industry, it's all about occupation and how many nights you can rent the property out. Limitations on that imposed by government would severely affect Airbnb owner returns.
Grant, but then From a property investor point of view, if I'm a property investor and I've got a lease agreement with a client, for example, it's not on Airbnb, I technically have a long-term kind of rental agreement in place there. Does this mean that we're not going to extend that to those kinds of individuals, or are we specifically looking at the Airbnb market? And if it is specific to the Airbnb market, why do I then not just have people on a long-term rental agreement?
Yes, I think, obviously in the Airbnb market, you can charge a premium for those nights that you rented out to make up for the service sort of offering that you have as an Airbnb owner, but also to make up for the nights that you may not rent a property out, particularly in Cape Town in the winter times when there's a higher vacancy rate. So the regulations, the long-term market's highly regulated at the moment, and, there's a lot of protection for both landlords and tenants. If you're going to rent it out on a short on a long-term basis to a short-term host, they would still be impacted by those regulations. So it wouldn't negate anything for them.
Mm-hmm. Grant, for some of these hosts or for some of the people that have these properties, I would have bought it as an investment property for the purposes of portfolio diversification, which historically there's never been anything wrong with that. Are we going to see some shift in trends, do you think, from perhaps how individuals use those properties or view their investment portfolios, at least from a real estate point of view?
Absolutely. It would both impact current owners with Airbnb properties, Airbnb hosts that are renting long-term properties, as well as developments that are being released at the moment into the market with Airbnb options as one of the selling points. So it would significantly impact the market. I do think that the regulations are, although necessary, need to be very careful on impacting Airbnb opportunities for owners, both on the return side as well as limiting how many nights they can use the property, because it does affect the economy ultimately with Airbnb hosts and tourists to Cape Town contributing a significant amount to the GDP. In South Africa.
Grant, from a property point of view, I was going to get into just what this then means. I mean, you touched on the fact that developers will now have to rethink whether or not they develop at the same pace or at the same scale as which they used to, because demand might be affected from the introduction of these sorts of regulations. But as a realtor, you operate in this space. Do you think that from an investment point of view as well, that investors will then say, do you know what, it's not worth it, or let's find an alternative?
Yeah, I think like in any market, there'll be an adjustment in the market. There may be a temporary lull in pricing and in property prices, as well as an adjustment in long-term rental, if that's where a lot of properties go to. But then it will sort of return to its heyday there. Ultimately, Cape Town is a destination that both foreigners and South Africans love being in and living in, and there is a limitation on how much stock can be built ultimately with the ocean on the one side and the mountain on the other. So although there'll be an adjustment for investors, my suggestion would be hold on, make sure you can make your payments and cover your bond, and the market will adjust again.
One can't believe, when you look at the scenario, I mean, you can't help but wonder whether or not the model just worked a little too well. I mean, it sounds in part like you are being penalized for having, the Airbnb model wasn't created in South Africa, to say the least, and it is working around the world. It sounds like someone might be upset that Cape Town is a popular destination. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it could be. I think, there's a lot of speculation around where these regulations come from. I think there is a requirement for regulation and licensing, just to control the market slightly. However, over-regulation could severely impact that market significantly. But I think like any model, a disruptive model that comes in, initially comes in disruption, nobody really knows what to do with it. And the government, like investors, lets it play out to figure out what to actually do with a model that is not known at the time it's implemented.
Grant, do you think there's value in regulating the pricing side of it rather than the rental terms? I mean, I think about something like peak times now. We're going into peak festive season. Cape Town properties typically increase in pricing at this point. Do you think tackling it from that perspective and saying perhaps we put in a price ceiling rather than regulating how many days people can go in for, would that be an alternative that would benefit consumers but also wouldn't be to the detriment of the owners?
I think the consideration needs to really be firstly the impact in the hospitality market. If you're going to regulate Airbnb, then are you going to also regulate hotel rooms, as an example, when demand is high? So you've got to keep that in mind. You know, and also I think once you start regulating pricing in one segment of the market, you need to, there's a slippery slope into regulating pricing in other markets, which then affects its practicality in terms of investment. And that, there I'm speaking about long-term rental controls, which have proven to be implemented in certain countries around the world, but haven't worked necessarily for the benefit of the consumer.
Well, we'll have to see how this shapes up. We know that the regulation hasn't yet gone through. It is just being proposed at this stage, but it certainly has some serious implications for Airbnb owners and in part for Airbnb users, the consumers that frequent these venues and these locations. We'll leave the conversation there, Grant. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Grant Smear, Director at Only Realty, on the proposed regulations to restrict the term rentals around Airbnbs.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's another Tuesday. It's another Agri Tuesday, not Property Tuesday this week. And we're taking a look at something quite interesting. It seems researchers at the University of Pretoria have discovered new species of dung beetles. I'm joined on the line by PhD student and researcher at the University of Pretoria, Christian Descourt, to take a look at the discoveries that he's made as part of his research. Good evening, Christian. Thanks so much for taking the time. Take me through this discovery. Two new species. How did we get to this point?
Thanks for the opportunity. Yes, it's two different species. The first one I discovered actually while I was walking to school picking up my kids. Imagine that. So the school is just 1.5 kilometers from my house. So in the mornings I do work and research work for this PhD. And then I take a breather and go and get the kids. So I was walking there the previous evening. It was raining quite heavily. And as I was walking, there I see this beetle among some ants. Now, this is strange. Dung beetles, they don't eat dung. They just, what is it doing amongst these ants? So immediately I was triggered. I picked the thing up. I held it, got the kids, went back to my house. Immediately had a look under the microscope and boom, it's a new thing. It's amazing. You don't often get this feeling like that, this is new. This is never seen before. So for this species, I've unfortunately only got this one specimen. We know that it most probably lives in close association with ants, but what it actually does there, we don't know. Obviously, the ants will give it protection because they are, it's very aggressive ants. So it lives with these ants and it lives in these nets and it's quite well protected. So the other species, this is Ontophagus prachtig. Prachtig is the Afrikaans word for beautiful. It's a species that I discovered when I went through some unidentified specimens in a museum. I saw the thing, I knew that it was undescribed. And then I figured that it is in a group where all the beetles, that all the species that lives in the or that is in this group, eat millipedes. So I knew where this thing came from. So I asked a friend to be on the lookout for other specimens and asked him to check all millipede dead millipedes which he could find in the road, and boom, the next day he calls me, he says, I found this thing of yours. Now that's another, it just fits in perfectly. It was so nice. So he brought me the specimens. It's the same species. So, and I described that species as well. So, that's where they came from.
Christian, there are over 500 species of dung beetle in South Africa alone. I mean, aside from discovering new species, which is phenomenal in itself, how do dung beetles kind of fit into the ecosystem that is wildlife and that is everything that you study?
Okay, so dung beetles, they are a relatively well-known group. So you've got butterflies. Everybody knows butterflies. Dragonflies, a lot of people know dragonflies. Dung beetles, yes, there are a few specialists, and we know the group quite well. So, but the special thing about dung beetles is that they are soil engineers. So what do I mean with soil engineers? It means that they change the environment where they live in. So most dung beetles Yes, some live in ant nests, some live eat millipedes, but the biggest number of dung beetles eat dung. So they go to a dung pad, they remove the dung by burying it underground. What are they doing when they bury this dung underground? They are eliminating the breeding ground for pests like bacteria, viruses, flies. So that's a good thing. Another good thing is they take the dung underground. So they immediately bring nutrients underground. This is nitrogen, all these stuff, all these elements that they take underground, which is necessary for plant growth. And they distribute it. It's not in one spot. It goes from all over the show. So it's immediately good for grass recovery. What they also do by digging holes into the soil, they loosen it up and they open it up so that rainwater can more easily penetrate into the soil. So they also, by removing this dung pad, they're taking when all these elements that are in the dung, it gets dissolved in the rainwater and it flows into natural river systems. And all these elements can cause algae blooms and are sometimes actually poisonous or bad for the river systems. So they stop this pollution. So without dung beetles, life on Earth would be completely different from what we know it today.
Christian, when you look at it from a farming perspective, can dung beetles enhance crop qualities, crop yields? I mean, you did mention that they are soil engineers. Can they be useful in the farming world over and above what we get from them in their natural kind of ecosystem?
Exactly. So what normally happens on farms is, or it used to happen, these days farmers are getting a bit more, they're becoming clever. When they spray ticksicides on the cattle, the older stuff was really bad. What I mean with this, it kills the ticks, but it gets absorbed into the animals. And the only way the animal can get rid of these chemicals is by excreting it in the dung. So these chemicals don't change a lot in this process of being absorbed and being excreted. So it is still very poisonous for dung beetles. So the dung beetles die. And what happens then is that when there are fewer and fewer dung beetles, you get on farms where there's all these, the whole farm is covered in white, dried out dung pads that just lay there. So what happens is, when there are no dung beetles to remove these, where the dung pad actually falls, nothing grows under it. It's 30 by 30 centimeters of grazing that you lose. But what also happens is that the rainwater dissolves the nutrients in the dung and it goes straight into the soil under the dung. What then happens is the grass absorbs all these high concentrations of nutrients and it becomes unpalatable for the cattle. So what it can happen is that you lose per dung pad about 1 square meter of grazing. Now imagine a cow can produce about 20 kilograms of dung per day. So you can lose about close to 20 square meters of grazing per day that you lose if you lose the dung beetles. So that is why we need to protect them, keep them in the environment so that they can remove the dung and keep the soil healthy.
Nature's soil engineers and pest control at the same time, keeping our environment healthy, but also being very good for farming. Dung beetles, what a surprise.
Yes,
there.
Yes.
Thanks so much, Christian. We'll leave the conversation there. It was a fantastic conversation. It's always good to get some insights around the things that make our world and our agricultural space turn. That was Christian Deschot, who is the PhD researcher and student at the University of Pretoria, who's discovered 2 new dung beetles to add to the more than 500 we have in South Africa.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We've come to the end of the show, folks. If you've missed any of the conversations, you know exactly where you can catch up on them. It's coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Hoss is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. It also means from my side, good night.